This might be an all-time low, but while I haven't seen The Lion King, I did see some of the spin-offs.
So you saw Lion King 2, Simba's Pride.
He saw Simba's Pride.
I think I did.
Oh, man.
Soundtrack wasn't banging, let me tell you.
Welcome to the B-side.
This is the Music Snobs on Film. I am your host and lead voice, Arthur, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Isaac and Jahan. And this is a groundbreaking episode for us. This is the last show of our first seasonal format, episode number 8 for both the Music Snobs podcast and Snobs on Film. Congratulations, we made it. I mean, we made it. Like,
we didn't kill each other. Came close.
Well, we're all here.
Came close.
we're all here. It got a little.
Do
gladiator.
We still love each other? Do we still love each other? Jahan is suspiciously quiet right now.
So yes, we brought you 8 shows in 8 months, January through the season finale that we're recording right now for August 2019, and the Music Snobs will be back in 2020. Along with Snobs on Film. But there may be some extras that we drop along the way, so we're not going to be completely ghosts while we plan the season number 2. So today we want to focus on the perfect or imperfect marriage between music and movies. There have been several occasions on the Music Snobs where we've talked about music, but we haven't talked about the film where that music appeared in. And conversely, we've done Snobs on Film episodes where we've talked about films, but not the music. Most recently, we spent over an hour talking about Do the Right Thing for the 30th anniversary, but we actually did not mention the soundtrack. So we thought that it would be a good idea to combine forces and focus on soundtracks themselves and the symbiotic relationship between music and film that probably began out of necessity, where music was an accompaniment to silent films in the early 20th century, before audio dialogue could be recorded and tracked to the film. So when film technology evolved, so did the musical accompaniment, and movie studios began to hire composers to write music or scores specifically for that film. This music was then packaged into albums and commercially released, creating soundtracks that we know now. Interesting note, the first soundtrack, anybody know? Take a guess.
No idea.
1938, Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was the first soundtrack for sale. So fast forward, 60-ish years, and soundtracks are still going strong. Sometimes they herald a film's release. Most recently, we have the live-action remake of Disney's The Lion King, featuring Beyoncé's Spirit. And this is a song for Beyoncé that did not appear in the 1995 animated original. So it's clearly designed to be artist-driven. And I would think, hopefully, to draw audiences to the theater. So I personally want to know, Isaac, I'm going to throw this to you. Beyoncé.
You're throwing Beyoncé to me. Okay.
I am. Get ready. Don't.
What was you about to say?
Is this gonna entice you to go and see the live action Lion King that you know that she's gonna be doing this new song?
No. But I think the Lion King, I think, is a good example of what we're talking about here. I mean, just to back up a little bit, when we were actually talking about, you know, how we wanted to wrap up this season and the fact that we wanted to combine, you know, both shows and do this, you know, on a grand scale. It, you know, we threw around a lot of ideas, and I think that this one, when it came up, it almost seemed very obvious after the fact. You know, right. Hindsight is 2020. This relationship between movies and music is about as intimate and as natural a relationship I've ever seen between two genres, two different artistic mediums. So the Lion King, I think, is a great example, because the original Lion King film, that Elton John song, Circle of Life, I mean, come on, you know, that's basically, ingrained in our psyche now, and maybe mm-hmm. even for people who've only seen the film once or never even seen the film. Yeah. That song is you know, part of is a cultural cornerstone now. And when you said, okay, there's going to be new material, you know, recorded for this next Lion King movie, which from what I understand is a, you know, almost a scene by scene replication of the first film. But just in, you know, not even live action, it's, you know, digitized. I think the entire movie is digital. It doesn't entice me only because I still am so strongly connected to those original songs for the original film. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to that relationship more than anything else. I almost feel like you really can't do it better than that for that film. So saying that you're going to record a new song for this movie, I feel like, why? You know what I'm saying? It's like you perfected it the first time. What's the point? So to answer your question, nah, but that's just me. Maybe some other people are more enticed, and maybe a younger generation who didn't see I would say even for younger kids, it's almost like Michael Jackson and Michael Jordan.
I mean, I think if you're of a certain age and you have children, you've seen The Lion King.
Yeah, you know the Lion King. Right. You know, I don't care what age you are. You know The Lion King, you know Circle of Life. So I can't imagine anybody, you know, being enticed to go see it just because Beyonce, even as big as Beyonce is, that she's going to record a new song for it.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen The Lion King.
What? How is that possible?
I've seen the play twice. I mean, the play, the musical. I've seen the musical twice, I think. I've seen it in LA and in London. But yeah, I think
you know what, that
I know that sounds crazy.
You know what, it doesn't sound crazy.
But yeah, it doesn't sound crazy to me.
If you know, if you don't know Jahan, if you don't know him personally, all you need to know about him to sum him up is that he's seen the musical twice and never seen the movie. That's Jay.
Well, you know what I'm saying? That's Jay. I mean, I'll concede that point, but still.
My man.
I mean, I didn't see The Lion King until you know, after I got married and had children.
I think I saw The Lion King way before I was a parent. I think I saw that movie, because what year was that? 95.
Yeah, so okay. You were just like, what?
I was early 20s or whatever. I think I was still a teen, but I saw that movie when it came out, you know. That was of that era, and I think that this is germane to the topic, because mm-hmm. that was that era of films, of Disney films, that transcended age, and all of a sudden, you know, grown people could go see these movies even without kids. And part of that enticement was the music.
Yeah, I mean, the first soundtrack album was a Disney movie. I think that speaks volumes.
So, but you get my point though, like, okay, so the early Disney movies, you know, going back to what Arthur is talking about, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, on through all the time before any of us were born. Yeah, those had, you know, music in them and these songs that became indelible to the culture. But mm-hmm. I think in the 90s, you know, Aladdin, Lion King, and I think there, Pocahontas, and then there was a couple other ones. Nemo later on in the 90s, early 2000s, yeah. It became these things where, you know, yeah, you could take your kids to them, but then adults were loving these films as well. And I think the music has something to do with that. You know, the Circle of Life is a great tune, but if you are an adult, you probably get a little bit more meaning out of that song than maybe, you know, a 9-year-old is getting.
Sure. I can believe that.
But I mean, I do believe that there is an artist driven component. I remember in 1999, Disney did an animated Tarzan movie, and the fact that Phil Collins did the soundtrack, that was part of the promotion. Mm-hmm. Elton John doing music for The Lion King was part of the promotion. And it kind of, I don't know, thinking about it now, it's kind of baffling. Children don't care about that. They don't know who Phil Collins is, right? Their parents know who Phil Collins is.
Maybe, yeah, and I think it adds a bit of prestige to the film as well, that we're taking uh-huh. this very seriously. And in these films, let's be clear about this, in the films that we're talking about, the songs are, you know, these are musicals. The songs are sung by the characters in the film. They move the plot forward. You know, they're not like background material. So mm-hmm. I could see in that context, yeah, saying, okay, well, Phil Collins is writing the songs for this movie. It's almost, it's the same as saying this person's acting in this movie or this person is directing this film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of Phil Collins, he's got, that cat has got a disproportionate number of his songs featured in movies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
Often they'll use the same song over and over again in different movies.
Yeah, my ultimate movie song, I've never even seen this movie, is Against All Odds.
Yeah, you mentioned that on another show, on a different show.
Yeah, that's it for me. But okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, I don't want to stay too long in the animated world, because this exists also in movies with real people acting in real humanistic situations, where the song of the film is part of the driver for the film itself. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I phrased that right, so forgive me. But okay, Against All Odds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's another. Kiss from a Rose by Seal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
From Batman Forever, which might be on everybody's bottom three list of Batman movies ever made.
Right.
But the song is absolutely fantastic.
Well, I think though there's two different things we're talking about, and it's interesting to me because in one category you have these songs that actually are, like I said before, very closely connected to the plot of the movie. You know, you talk mm-hmm. about the great James Bond songs. You know, not the Goldfingers or the
Diamonds
Are Forever or the Thunderballs, whatever. You know,
nobody does it better.
The Skyfalls. You know, you mm-hmm. talk about these songs that open up the movie and give you a glimpse of what you're about to see for the next 2 hours. But then in the other category, it's really interesting to me, like you're talking about the early movie houses with the silent films used to have the music pits. So you mm-hmm. you know, you would have people playing piano, or you know, I've actually seen films that depict that, you know, before the talkies came out, or they were called talkies, weren't they? Or yeah. No, they were the silent films and then the talkies.
Right.
So the silent films, where you'd have musicians there playing music, the need for music, you know, it wasn't enough just to come to this movie house and watch this film and read the subtitles or whatever. You had to hear music. I think that really speaks to it. So it's almost like two different things. And this marriage between them seems very innate, you know, between music and movies. It seems almost necessary to the point where I'm wondering, you know, can, obviously music can live without film, but can film live without music?
I think film can live without music,
we should be clear. We're talking about soundtracks and songs and not scores.
Right, right.
That's
right.
A good point. They're totally distinct. I mean, a song could be anything. It could be written for the movie. Mm-hmm. It could be just used in the movie, but it could actually come from somewhere else. It can already be out there. It can be old. It could be new. Whereas scores are typically written specifically for the movie, generally incidental music, often orchestral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do want to kind of focus in on what you love more, the movie or the song. And to your point about film not being able to exist without music, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
After the first maybe 15 minutes of the film, there's all but no music, and the lack of sound is used in the same way as an accompaniment to move the story and to bolster the storyline,
mm-hmm.
by accentuating the silence, the absence of sound in space. And it's masterful. Mm-hmm. You don't notice that the sound is not there.
The whole purpose of not having the whole purpose of withdrawing the music from that scene and making it more powerful because of the silence is because the audience is used to hearing music. So if there was absolutely no music, period,
mm-hmm.
then you don't have that device anymore.
It's when you watch that film, and it's not just a scene. I mean, we're talking about a lot of, over an hour and a half of film with no soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that wasn't done properly, this is the point that I'm getting to, if that wasn't done properly, you would miss the sound, because it would, pardon the pun, sound like you know, somebody forgot to add music to this.
Like you was in the wrong, like you got the wrong cut of the movie.
Right. Right. And if you added music to it, if you added a score to it, it would actually lessen the impact of the film, of the visual. Mm-hmm.
That applies equally whether or not you're using a score or whether you're using a soundtrack for that, right? That applies equally. But are you saying therefore that kind of sounds like you're going against what you were asking, which is you don't need a song, you just need the visuals. Is that what you're saying, or does it depend on the context?
I think it depends on the context, but even more so, I think it depends on being in the hands of a capable director to make the decision on where the soundtrack needs to be.
Of course, yeah.
Take a movie like Tim Burton's Batman from 1989, right? There are two albums. There's an original motion picture soundtrack composed by Danny Elfman, and then there's a Prince album, music from the motion picture. And what, three songs? One or two completely are, you can hear in the movie. And the third song, which I think is the future, is heard in the background, like coming out of a passing car. You know, you can tell that music was put in the movie. Prince music was put in the movie.
Because they paid for it.
Because they paid for it, and it's a market driver, and you know, and there's a promotional campaign behind it, and all of that. But it doesn't necessarily fit. You wouldn't. The music doesn't help the scenes.
Yeah, I think the 89 Batman, I think, is one of the examples to me. And I remember thinking this when I saw the movie as a preteen or whatever. That was one of the worst examples of music placement. I think that the party man scene when Jack Nicholson, the Joker, is, you know, tearing up that museum or whatever. I'm like, why wasn't that louder? Why wasn't the music dominating that scene? It was like that was the place where that song was supposed to be. But it was like almost like it was shoved in the back almost.
Yeah.
But you know what? When it comes to soundtracks, like exactly like that, like new material, new songs recorded by famous artists in particular, how much of it is a marketing tool rather than the sounds that actually truly complements the vision, the genuine vision of the filmmakers?
I agree with what you're saying as far as increasingly now, and we can get off the Batman thing, but you know, Batman, Prince, those are my, that's like a sweet spot for me, so I'm gonna stay on it for just another second. I think that Prince did an excellent job of marrying that music to the film. Like those songs, you know, he's telling the story of that film through those songs. I think he did an expert job.
That's literally music inspired by the film.
Exactly. And I think that Bat Dance, if you remember, hit the radio maybe a month, maybe longer than that before the film came out. And Bat Dance is one of the reasons that movie has such a big opening, because the video came out. And this is pre-internet. So this is before we had all these behind-the-scenes access before a film dropped. Bat Dance comes out. We start getting glimpses of the film. And then we hear, you know, Jack Nicholson. We hear Michael Keaton's voice. We hear Vicki Vale's voice, Kim Basinger's voice. So it was like it built up a lot of anticipation for this film. And I think he did a great job. I just think Tim Burton did a horrible job editing the music into the film in post. But I agree with what you're saying, Jahan. Now it does feel more like marketing. And I can't remember recently in the last few years, I can't remember, you know, one of the movies I saw other than maybe Black Panther with, what's the song, Arthur?
All the Stars.
All the Stars. Yeah. I can't remember like a huge song that, you know, and really to be honest, All the Stars, it didn't, you know, I remember it being in the film, but it wasn't like,
it was in the end credit.
Yeah, it wasn't like a moment in the film. It wasn't like a John Hughes moment. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't like it defined the film and defined what was going on.
It wasn't Danger Zone
for
Top Gun.
Right, it wasn't Danger Zone. Yeah, so that, I agree 100% with what Jahan is saying. Now it feels like an extra, like a extra limb or something added on to the movie that doesn't really need to be there, except for the purposes of marketing. It seems like they've forgotten how to, they know how to market, but they've forgotten how to integrate it into the film so it actually makes the film better.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I do feel, I feel similar to how I started this off with The Lion King and Beyoncé's Spirit. We're putting, you know, her and her star power behind this movie as a vehicle for movie ticket sales and for, you know, and for song sales.
Mm-hmm. But I don't have any problem with that when it helps the film. And I think the best, you know, you ask, okay, you
helps know, the film or helps the story?
Helps this. Well, I'm saying film, but I mean the narrative, the story.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So yeah, I'm not talking about box office. Although I don't, you know, I don't begrudge them that. You got to sell tickets. But at the same, but yeah, I don't mind it if it's helping the narrative. But you asked, yeah. Originally, you asked, you know, is it the movie that, you know, audiences are they going? Is it the movie that's most important to them, or is it the music that's with the movie? Obviously, people go to movies because it's the movie that's drawing them. It's the film. It's the narrative. It's the story. It's the stars. It's whatever, mm-hmm. you know, is happening mm-hmm. on screen. But I think nothing is better than when that perfect song aligns with that perfect moment in the film. And I think one of the best examples of all time is Whitney Houston's "I Will Always Love You" in The Bodyguard. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you are...
Never seen it.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, I haven't seen it either, but... I don't need to. I've heard the music. But I'm saying, I don't need to. Like, I remember...
Hold on, neither
remember,
one of you have ever seen it?
No, my girlfriend at the time had the album. Like, I haven't seen that. I haven't heard the album either. I've never seen Waiting to Exhale. My girlfriend had that album.
I feel like I need to echo something that Jahan said to me many years ago on the music side. Have you ever been with a woman?
My girls ain't corny, bro. My girls got tits.
How are you your age and you've never seen The Bodyguard?
Oh, my God.
You've been with women and you've never seen The Bodyguard?
I haven't seen The Preacher's Wife.
First of all, The Bodyguard is not a bad film. So taste, you can take that out of it. It's not a bad movie. It's a very mainstream, you know, predictable film, but it's not a bad movie. But okay, let me just describe this scene to you heathens. So at the end of the film, spoiler alert, when they, you know, actually, you know what? It's not predictable because everybody else except for you guys has seen the movie. So I'm going to have to spoil it for you too. Sorry. But at the end of the movie,
please feel free.
Yeah.
At the end of the film, when the two stars do not get together, it doesn't end with them together. They go their separate ways. And, you know, it's during that climactic moment when you realize, oh, shit, they're going to go their separate ways. And it's, you know, the final kiss and the goodbye at the airport. And when Whitney's voice drops in with that first line, bruh. I don't care how hard you are. You know what I'm saying? I don't care how tough you are. I don't care. That hits you. You're gonna feel that one in your heart. You know what I'm saying? Because it's perfect.
Your eyes water?
No, it ain't even about. It ain't because it's almost not. It's not so much sad. I guess it is sad, but it's just like a perfect moment. It's like, damn, if you gotta say goodbye to somebody, let that shit be playing when you're saying goodbye. You know, it's just from a technical standpoint, from an artistic standpoint, I just can't believe
that this is your example. I mean, like, no disrespect, but this,
what, of a perfect song and a perfect time in the movie?
Yeah,
when you see the film, even if you hate it, you will have to admit that was the perfect moment. I agree with Arthur's earlier point about Top Gun. To me, that's another great example. Danger Zone, perfect at that moment in the film. So there's perfect songs that you hear outside of the movie, and you know again, like the Black Panther song, but it's like that's like so, you know, not even on the same level as a lot of these other examples where the song hits. Eye of the Tiger in Rocky 3, I think it is, hits at the exact right moment, and it's like, oh my God, and it immortalizes both the scene and the song at the same exact time. And that happened in The Bodyguard. You heartless motherfucker. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I get what you mean. I get what you mean. I mean, when it works perfectly, when there's that perfect, as you said, marriage, it makes it indelible. And in the best cases, it definitely wouldn't work as well without those particular songs.
Yeah.
I hear you. And vice versa. Sometimes songs can resonate with you once you've seen them in a particular movie, in a particular scene, and you've had that emotional kind of assist, if you like, that you might not necessarily have liked the song without that.
That sums up a lot of John Hughes-esque, you know, mid-80s type beat, you know, songs. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of those type of songs that I may not have connected to as strongly, but then they have such a strong connection to the film for me. But I think that for everything we've talked up until this point, we're talking about music being added in post. But I know I've read articles, I've seen directors talking about it and writers who specifically write, you know, a scene with a certain song in mind. Or they you know, Michael Mann famously solicits specific artists, you know what I'm saying, to get, you know, specific music into his movies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of his necessarily, but Quentin Tarantino, he has a library-like knowledge of everything that goes around film, and including all the soundtracks over the years and songs that have been used in different films, etc. And I think he, by his own admission, sometimes he's seen a film and thought, ah, this would go perfectly in this scene, or, you know, oh, I'm going to use this for that.
Does that sometimes get in the way for you guys? Does it take you out of the movie sometimes?
Yes and no. Sometimes it can be distracting. You know, if I've seen a film that uses a particular song to great effect, to see it in another one, it can be hard for me to separate my memory of that other film and everything that goes with it. So sometimes perhaps the filmmakers just like the song and they want to use it again. It's nothing to do with the other movie, but sometimes I wonder if they're trying to capitalize on the power that a previous scene in a previous movie had, and they're hoping that that will trigger the same sort of feeling when you watch their film. But then, you know, like, I can't be mad at people who do it, I suppose, if I'm not mad at hip-hop, because, you know, it's sampling, I guess. You know, Quentin Tarantino is digging in that respect.
Yeah, but I think that, and this, I think, I know before we move off of this, I think that to answer or to kind of go back to what Arthur was talking about earlier about the marketing, what we're seeing now is that not only is music and songs, are music and songs being used for particular scenes within the film, they're being used to sell trailers. Mm-hmm. And these are songs that won't even appear in the movie, in the finished product. One of the biggest examples is Logan. Logan came out, I think it was last year, 2017. I think it was early 2018. Logan came out, and one of the first trailers had Johnny Cash's, Arthur, what's the song that starts with "I Hurt Myself Again"? Is that the name of the song? I don't know. I'm not a Johnny Cash dude.
No, well, I think the song's just called Hurt, but I don't remember how the lyric starts. But go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, Jay, you know what song I'm talking about. It starts with "I Hurt Myself Again." Isn't it originally a Nirvana track or something?
Nine Inch Nails.
So and he did it. Apparently, he did it much better than they did. So I've seen that song in a lot of different clips for a lot of different television shows, films, etc. But it really worked well in this trailer for Logan. The trailer was perfect. You can tell that the trailer was perfectly matched to that song specifically. And it was, I think it worked, you know, it helped to sell, you know, it helped to get people excited about this film. But I'm kind of torn as far as, like, how do I feel about that? Because it's like that, I don't believe the song was in the actual finished product. It was just used to sell the trailer. So in terms of what you're talking about, as far as marketing a movie, songs, I think that, you know, and maybe this is great news for artists, for musical artists, because songs have actually stepped up a notch. You know, they've gone to another level. It's like, hey, you don't have to just save us for the movie. We can help you in your trailers. We can help you market this. We can help you market that. So that's another level of this, another layer.
Yeah, I agree. Ultimately, I think it all depends on how it's done. A great example is Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas, where he uses a huge amount of songs in the movie, often not just for a kind of tonal quality, but almost for a sort of storytelling role. The movie, it covers 25 years. And the songs sometimes are there to signify the time period that we're in. And sometimes it's there to signify romance or signify violence or whatever. But actually, my favorite one is a very unexpected choice. It's he uses Eric Clapton's Layla, but he uses the outro to Layla, which is this kind of, I don't know, this kind of country soft rock kind of vibe. It's got a melancholy vibe to it, but it's not like super aggressive or anything, certainly compared to the rest of the song. And he uses it to depict the discovery that the character played by Robert De Niro, Jimmy, has been murdering pretty much everybody he works with in order to keep the spoils of a particular robbery. And you just start to see body after body after body, and we basically start seeing all these corpses, and this this kind of country soft rock tune is playing in the background. And I always thought it was a trip, but I always really liked the use of it.
I think that it's, for me, it's okay or more acceptable to use those quote unquote standards or, you know, unoriginal songs in your film if it's a period piece, you know, if it's a film that's defining a certain era. But when it's a modern film, when it's taking place, a contemporary film, I feel like we lose something if you're not, because film and television can help you discover music. You know, I remember watching Entourage on HBO, and, you know, whether you hated the show or not, their music supervisor was dope. I forgot his name. He's done a lot of HBO films. But there's a lot of songs he would just introduce, you know, unexpected stuff he would introduce on the show that when Spotify became available, he would throw up, you know, here's the songs that we're playing. These are like, you know, modern songs that you had never heard of, you know, an artist that you could discover. I mentioned Michael Mann earlier. You know, he would, you know, have music or commission, you know, songs or whatever, or find artists that were contemporary to define a contemporary television show or movie. And so I feel like we lose something. You know, 007, the James Bond movies and the John Barry scores and soundtracks, the songs that he did, the artists he worked with, you can go through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, listen to those songs now, and you get a sense of that era. You know, you can, it's almost like a history lesson of what was going on at the time, just musically. So I feel like, to John's point, like when you hear Goodfellas, that's a, you know, as a film takes place in a certain time period, not a contemporary film at the moment it was filmed. So I feel like, yeah, it's appropriate to use those songs. But yeah, when a Quentin Tarantino movie comes out, and, you know, his current one is obviously a period piece. But if it's a contemporary film, I don't necessarily want to hear a bunch of old songs. I feel like you lose something there in the discovery, if that makes any sense.
No, it does.
I don't know. I mean, I think it can work both ways. I think, like, I can't think of an example, but I'm going to make one up. Just imagine if there was a mature black romance, kind of in the vein of Love Jones, if that dropped, and in a key scene they used the Isley Brothers' Footsteps in the Dark. Wouldn't that be dope?
No, I wouldn't like that. And the reason I wouldn't like that is because it's such an stat. We already know that song. You know what I'm saying? It's like, that's Love Jones. When Love Jones dropped, it had a bunch of original music in there where we may have known those artists, but then it's like, man, that really defined that era. You know, you can go back and listen to that soundtrack and it'll take you right back to, I think that's 1994. So if you put, like, you know, a standard, you know, if you put Ain't No Mountain High Enough or something like that, and I've seen this in like contemporary television shows and music, sometimes I feel like they're expecting the music to carry the weight of the narrative, and then it's like the scene or whatever isn't as strong because you're thinking that this song is going to do the heavy lifting for you. And I feel like it's almost like they feel like, okay, people have a strong connection to this song already, so if we put it in this particular scene, this will be, it's almost like that's the part of the storytelling that we're doing. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that this stuff be used as a crutch, like either the movie or like either visuals or the song be used as a crutch for the other. I'm not suggesting that. The sound, you know, we're talking about soundtracks. I mean, the soundtrack to My Life, I don't need it to be contemporary. Now, I appreciate it can be different if you're talking about visuals in the cinema, but I don't know if it should be.
So look, we're starting to get into a subject that I wanted to explore a little bit more. The idea that songs, I don't know, manipulate us into liking a scene or even an entire film. And now,
well, I think to me, if you're asking about manipulation, like I said earlier, I do feel a sense of manipulation when it's a song specifically for a trailer or something like that, and it's like, it's clearly a marketing move.
Just the way that all modern trailers are done today now is so corny. It's so typical. It's like one guy made it once, one editor did it, and that poor fellow's been ripped off to Kingdom Come. They should just get some creativity. But I hate the way these songs are being covered now in modern trailers, and they're being reharmed in a darker, kind of more melancholy way, more sinister way. I hate it. A lot of the time they'll use a musical motif by taking something, one particular sound, like a clock ticking or water dripping or a foot tapping or whatever, and they'll establish a rhythm with it throughout the trailer. It's been done and done and done to death, and they need to get more creative. But yeah, definitely taking these songs, covering them, reharmonizing them in this kind of sinister way. Nah, it's for the birds. Get some creativity and do it differently.
What about you, though, Arthur? Do you feel like some of these, you know, some of this soundtracking or the placement of songs is a manipulation? Is a manipulative move?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, in prepping for this show, I had a really, really hard time coming up with contemporary examples of songs being, you know, a driver for me wanting to go see the film. And it was much easier for me to come up with examples of films that I either saw or didn't see on the strength of the music that was in it. Mm-hmm. For example, Flashdance. I liked the music and I wanted to see the movie that accompanied this music. Or, and notice how I said that, because that's how I was looking at it, you know? Mm-hmm. Footloose is an example of me not wanting to see the film, because I did like Kenny Loggins, but I didn't care for the tune very much. I wanted to see National Lampoon's Vacation because of Lindsey Buckingham's Holiday Road. Mm-hmm. That was my joint, you know?
That song, doesn't that shit just put you in a good mood? But then
It just puts you in a good mood.
I can't separate that song from the film, though. It's just like I hear that song and I smile because I think of not just the song, but then Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo,
yeah. But you know, most recently, I really struggled trying to find some examples of me wanting to go see a movie because of the music that was in it. That wasn't like associated to like a musical. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's a good example before we move off of this. Here's a quick example of, to me, manipulation, which went when the music went the wrong way, and that is the Black Panther soundtrack. Because this was marketed as Kendrick Lamar's soundtrack, right?
That's right. And we talked about this extensively.
We talked about this extensively in a previous episode of Snobs on Film, which you guys can go back and listen to, the Black Panther episode. But this was a soundtrack that, to me, when I heard it, I was shocked because it seemed to have absolutely nothing to do with this movie. Mm-hmm. I think with maybe the exception of the hit song, the All the Stars song, but really, there was so much material on this album that sounded almost antithetical to the message or the tone or the mood of the film.
Yeah, this is what happens when the purpose is not to be a soundtrack, but when the purpose is cross promo.
Exactly. I agree with you to some degree that, yeah, there's a lot of cross promotion going on now. Mm-hmm. And I think the Black Panther soundtrack is a big example of that. This soundtrack had absolutely nothing to do, not just lyrically. It didn't have, it was lyrically as well, but mm-hmm. not just lyrically, but just the tone, the themes, you mm-hmm. know, it was just mm-hmm. nothing to do with this movie. And compare that to something like with Above the Rim, which did, if not in exact lyrical content and at least mood and tone, it matched that film. So there does seem to be a disconnect now.
You know where it does work, though? The soundtrack for Into the Spider-Verse.
Yes. Wait a minute. You know what? I'm going to agree with you on the strength of only hearing a few of the songs. I haven't heard the whole soundtrack, but as what was played during the film. I agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah. That worked a lot better.
Yeah. It definitely fit the mood and the tone of that movie and the energy of that film. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let me flip it on you. Let me use something that I know we're all very familiar with. Mm. The Boomerang soundtrack. Mm. Is that cross promo?
I think it's cross promo. I think Boomerang's cross promo. I think Waiting to Exhale was cross promo.
But I think they were cross promo, but they're also perfectly used in that film, especially the, I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, as far as, you know, you should have brought your ass home last night, that line, or the Toni Braxton song. I don't know which came first, mm-hmm. but that was, you know, it was a perfect marriage. It defined that, it fit perfectly with that scene and with the movie, the third act of that movie. So, cross promo in the sense that, yeah, it had all the, you know, the LaFace and, you know, all everybody that was popular mm-hmm. at that time was on that soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it wasn't like the Black Panther example. It was almost like they completely ignored the movie and just made what they thought were hot tracks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let me contrast it now with a film from a few years later, Love and Basketball. And I'll specify two tunes that were on the soundtrack. Maxwell's This Woman's Work and mm-hmm. Michelle Indego Cello's Fool of Me. That's
when that ball drops, when that basketball drops and Michelle's comes on and that beat hits, it's like, doom. Oh man, come on. That's perfect. Perfect.
Right. And we've talked about that specifically on this show, I think a couple of times before, but Maxwell's This Woman's Work in the love scene, that's such a beautiful song to have in a scene like that. And that's an example of something. I can't imagine a different song in that scene.
Great film. Shout out to Gina Price, I think it's Blythewood. Yeah, shout out to her. Beautiful and brilliant movie.
Well, I want to get to a point that I had alluded to in one of my previous remarks. The period where the marriage between soundtracks and the films that they appear in just got it right, and that would be the 1980s. Before we get to that, I want to thank everyone that has been leaving us comments and ratings in Apple Podcasts for both shows, The Music Snobs and Snobs on Film. And I encourage you to leave more. We need more to keep doing these shows. More ratings, more comments. We can be found on Spotify as well, where you can follow us. We're in Stitcher. We are in Google's podcast channel. Everywhere that fine RSS feeds are distributed.
Wait, do these give any money? Which of these pays us the most, bro?
Oh, that would be Apple Podcasts.
Wait a minute, we're getting paid? One of y'all got some explaining to do.
Right, exactly. No, we don't. We don't get anything.
So listen, this is the season finale for these shows. So let me ask you guys, if you had to, people, you know, over the next, during the hiatus, I'm sure people are going to go back and check out the back catalog. So what do you guys recommend? Like, let's say I'm new and I want to check out, Snobs on Film. What episode should I go to like really tell me about this show and tell me, you know, how dope it is?
Oh, well, for me, I mean, hands down, that would be the show that we did with actor Omar Dorsey of Queen Sugar and also of the last Halloween. I believe it came out in fall of 2018. We did a show with Omar called The Denzel Effect, where we talked about the concept of there could only be one dominant black actor at a time, Denzel Washington being the clear prototype for that. And in that episode, we looked at the rise of Michael B. Jordan, asked the question if he was next in line to be the one. It's a great show. I recommend everybody to check it out. It was our second episode for this season. And we even did a new segment that I'm anxious to try again maybe next season, called Black Roulette, where we took a black actor and the role that they played in a performance, but inserted them into a distinctly white film or television show. That was hilarious. I think Omar won that round.
I think that when you guys go back and check out some of the previous episodes, one thing I think you'll find is that there's things that are said and done on this show, on Snobs on Film and on The Music Snobs, that are not done on other music and music podcasts. So check it out. Be prepared.
Or that are done, but are done after our shows come out.
Right. And I was going to say I think it's the third episode of the season, Bond 2, BONTOO. That was the name of the episode. Hashtag Bond 2 ? That was one of my favorite episodes, not just because of the content, but because we, you know, prophesized almost what was about to happen immediately. It wasn't too long after that episode got released where kind of a lot of things we predicted happened as far as, you know, what was going to the new tone of the next Bond film. But to John's point, yeah, you are going to also see a pattern of, you know, things that we do and talk about that somehow end up in other media sources. That's all I'm gonna say about it. But somehow, you know, I don't know, haphazardly end up in other places without the kind of attribution you would expect when that happens. What TMS, what Music Snobs episode should people go back and check out?
I'm going to suggest that they go to a Music Snobs episode that we did entitled Let's Be Frank, You Don't Know Sinatra.
I knew you were going to say that.
That's right.
I knew you were going to say that. If you love John, go listen to this episode. He got beef.
For me, it's a toss-up between that and the music journalism episode. The Frank episode, I'm partial to it because A, I like that kind of music, and B, I think this particular episode came out around the time of the Quincy documentary, I think. So, you know, if you like that documentary, our episode on Frank is a nice companion to that.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And also, you mentioned the journalism episode, Media Assassins. I think it was number two. We had my man Dayton Thomas from Vibe Magazine was on, and excellent, excellent episode. So check that out as well. Check out both seasons. And then there's back catalogs you guys can go and look at before we start doing the seasonal format. There's a lot of episodes out there you can go check out and get your fill before during the hiatus.
All right. Maybe the greatest decade for the marriage between soundtrack and film, the 1980s. Mm. I think that this was the peak. I think that the songs of that era really transcended the cinema and defined the decade itself.
Let me ask you a question. I think I agree with you let's be honest though, we're a little bit biased because we're mostly 80s kids here. I think we should acknowledge that bias, but let me ask you guys this question though, because I think I agree with you. How much did MTV have to do with that? Because here, for the first time ever, because we didn't have this in the 60s, didn't have this in the 70s, for the first time ever, we had video and music extremely accessible if you had cable in the 80s. And I guess, I don't know, John, in the UK, was it available in the UK in the early 80s or was it late 80s?
Yeah, speaking for my family, we didn't get it until, I want to say, like the 2000s at the earliest.
I don't know. I mean, I won't deny that MTV had an effect and had a hand in this.
Because you remember, Arthur, you remember those early videos, but even in the 80s, where you had, if it was associated with a film, you would have interspersed throughout the video, you'd have clips of the movie. You know what I'm saying? That was very common.
Right.
So that was very, even if you didn't see the film, that marriage was there. So the mediums of film and video and music was very prominent in a way that hadn't been prominent before in our homes. So I'm just asking, do you think that had anything to do with it?
I mean, obviously MTV, because it was novel and because it was so far reaching, it put videos in front of the eyes of millions of young people who went to go subsequently and see these films.
I think that you're right. The 80s did do more, you know, is in comparison to other decades, probably did more to marry the music of these films with the cultural zeitgeist at the moment. And I think proof of that is that there's so many films and television shows now going back to that well, you know, Stranger Things obviously being the most prominent, but there's, you know, kind of like a backlash now to kind of, not a backlash, but a throwback era now. It's like people are going to that well of the 80s and getting into that nostalgia. I think part of that is because that music so heavily, the music that was associated with those movies did a lot of heavy lifting as far as capturing those moments in time.
I think it depends when you grew up. I think if you grew up in those eras, it would mean more to you. But if we're being objective about it, like, other eras have just as powerful songs, and you know, rather than argue with you, I'll just throw out some songs which I think are,
all right.
I'll just throw out some song titles that I think are pretty much iconic evidence of that. You have Somewhere Over the Rainbow from The Wizard of Oz. That's like the 30s. As Time Goes By from Casablanca. Yep. That's like the 40s, I think. You have Mrs. Robinson from The Graduate, you know, the Simon and Garfunkel tune. That's like, what, the 60s or 70s?
60s.
Late 60s.
Right, 60, okay, right. You have When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio. That's that's become like the iconic Disney melodic motif, right? Disney have rinsed it over the years.
Give me some 70s.
Superfly, Curtis Mayfield, theme from Shaft, Isaac Hayes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So now I'm wondering, is it not that the 80s was the greatest era? Is it more so that the 80s was the last great era? In other words, was the 80s the last great era of, you know, songs from movies capturing the zeitgeist of the culture?
We haven't even gone into musicals, right? Like, West Side Story, etc. We haven't even gone into those, and that might mm-hmm. those may be a different dimension.
I think that's separate. I think that's separate. Yeah.
So here's the thing: all these tunes that we've just mentioned, and you know, all the John Hughes tunes that you mentioned earlier, these are great, great tunes. You know, what's messing with "Gonna Fly Now" from Rocky? Mm-hmm. What's messing with "The Days of Wine and Roses" from the film of the same name? These are great tunes, and you know, Isaac, it's nice to see you use this term. I think it really fits. These are standards. Mm-hmm. You know, we could go for two more hours just mentioning song names. So my question is, are there songs on movie soundtracks today in the same volume that there were in the 70s, 60s, etc.?
No, but you hit it, volume.
Yeah. No, I don't think they are. Yeah, I don't think they are. And I think that the prime example is what we already mentioned. Two things is that one, that Logan trailer, where they depended upon, you know, a standard, so to speak, to sell that movie. And then the Black Panther soundtrack. I think the term that you use, cross promotion, is key to this conversation. It's not about so much matching a perfect scene, you know, or taking a scene and matching it with the perfect song, especially not a contemporary song. I think it's about cross promoting. How do we promote this? How do we promote this movie through a soundtrack? Who can we get on the soundtrack? Doesn't matter if the music is actually played during the movie. You know, we'll mm-hmm. play it in the trailer, or we'll play it over the end credits, whatever. We'll do a YouTube joint, Instagram, whatever. It's not necessarily about, you know, the artistic value of it. It's more so about cross promotion. Except in the vein of a Lion King or other musicals, mm-hmm. that's a different animal to me.
But I guess I'm pushing the 80s. And Jahan had said this word, because of the volume. And I do think that MTV had a hand in its promotion, but I can't put it too heavy on MTV because that costs money. Like, cable costs money then. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, hey, here's MTV and it's just on your television. Nah. Mm-hmm.
But it did. I mean, MTV, and I, you know, that was a minor point, but just to throw one last thing on it, MTV did, you know, MTV still exists. You know, I don't think anybody watches it, but MTV still exists. But MTV is a cultural artifact of the 1980s.
True.
You know what I'm saying? It's indelible to that time period. And what is MTV? It's music.
And beyond that, 80s and 90s.
Yeah, 80s and 90s, you know, Total Request Live, all that stuff. Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying, as far as the 80s are concerned, that's, you know, it's like hip hop. You know, hip hop existed long past the 80s, but it's the infancy and the mm-hmm. kind of the golden age of that.
And a lot of people call Generation X the MTV generation.
Exactly. That's the term mm-hmm. I was looking for, the MTV yeah. generation. So, and we are that yeah. generation.
I just want to acknowledge that it wasn't permeate, like it didn't automatically permeate like YouTube does. Like, in my house, I didn't have MTV in my house until like 1988.
Damn.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, John's got an excuse. He had an ocean between him
and without adding that. This is why I'm pushing it so strong. Without adding that context, you know. Mm-hmm.
Where did you watch videos at then?
It'd be like at my friend's house.
Okay. And then on Soul Train or whatever, in some of the local
like Video Jukebox or something like that. Right. You know, Video Jukebox. Soul Beat in Oakland.
You know, I know someone out there is going to feel me on this and throw up the fist in solidarity. But friends of mine, girls, boys, whatever, would make me tapes, like videotapes for 8 hours, high speed dubbing.
Mm-hmm. It almost sounds to me like you guys are saying that, or kind of like we're moving towards that idea that maybe, instead of saying the 80s was the greatest period, again, I kind of need to reiterate, it feels like you're saying that it was the last great period of this. And maybe there was some of that in the 90s, but not necessarily the way it was in the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, the 40s. And then you guys brought up the Kiss from a Rose, all
Yeah, I feel you, but on the level of Windmills of Your Mind from Thomas Crown Affair and the sheer volume of material at that time, nah, I don't think so.
So before we move into the roundtable, maybe we should just ask, you know, our listeners, you guys should comment, hit us on Twitter and let us know your favorite combination of music, of song and or soundtrack and film and or scene.
Our Twitter handle for the Music Snobs is Total Music Snobs. And yeah, we would like to get some feedback on what you think.
Roundtable.
All right, let's do the roundtable. one question, three opinions. We're calling this one, take the soundtrack, leave the film. Name the movie.
What's that? Hold on. What's that from?
That's from The Godfather.
Okay. I just leave
the
checking.
Gun. Take the cannoli. I see you.
All right. I mean, y'all already disappointed me with the bodyguard shit. So I was just making sure. Okay. All right.
Clemenza, I see you.
Take the soundtrack, leave the film. Got it.
Name the movie soundtrack or hit song from a soundtrack that you absolutely love, even though you have no desire to ever see the movie again.
I want to go last.
I think I went first last time. Jahan?
Mine's a bit of a cop-out. I mean, it's too easy because I don't think a single soul listening is going to disagree with me. So I'll take the soundtrack to Above the Rim and I'll leave the movie. actually, let me rephrase that. I took the soundtrack to Above the Rim and I left the movie.
I was about to say, did you ever see the movie? Did you walk out in the middle of the movie?
I did. Actually, it was kind of dope because it was like a double screening of the music video, which was like an extended music video, a kind of mini film for Snoop's Murder Was the Case. And at that time, Death Row was the thing. And boy, yeah, no. It was weird. It was a cool night, but the night was cooler than the movie, if you know what I mean. You know, what's funny about the 90s, though, is that I think the soundtracks generally punched above their weight. I think they were often better than the films that they were paired with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had the films been of a higher quality, then, you know, we might have had a classic era of movies matching soundtracks and vice versa.
What are some of the songs off of there?
Gosh, I mean, we could mention most of the tracks, but you had Regulate, Nate Dogg and Warren G.
Oh, yeah.
You had SWV, Anything. Sweet Sable, Old Time's Sake. You had Blowed Away by B. Rizel, which is produced by Devante. If you like that Diary of a Mad Band Jodeci era, boy, what a track.
Mm-hmm.
Afropuffs is on that one too, isn't it?
Yep. You had Rage. You had Big Pimpin' by the Dog Pound. Just like beautiful Cali vibe to it. But if you take a film like Easy Rider, which, you know, has a classic American rock soundtrack to it, Above the Rim is kind of on that level of soundtrack, not film, but soundtrack, because I don't think there's another soundtrack out there for that time that speaks to that time in the same way.
But you know, speaking of, here's what I appreciate about that soundtrack in that time period is because this is obviously before, you know, streaming and, you know, hooking up your iPod or your iPhone or whatever to your car. So not everybody had a CD player in the car. So if you had a cassette deck in your car, you needed something that banged from track one all the way to track 12 or 16 or whatever, because you wouldn't, you know, the rewind and fat, that was, you know, troublesome. That was bothersome. So you could put that. I remember putting Above the Rim in and just letting it play, you know, and then no matter what, when you got back in your car, it didn't matter what track it was on. When you have all bangers like that, you know, it's just such an appreciative experience, you know, that's what I remember about that soundtrack. I agree with you, Jay, because I may have a little bit more love for the film than you, but like you, I can't remember anything about it. So I remember Pac was in it, of course, and oh boy, Tisha Campbell's boyfriend,
Dwayne Martin.
That's all. Husband, yeah. That's all I can remember.
Okay, I struggled a little bit. Did a little soul searching for my pick. This is a soundtrack that I have talked about in bits and pieces throughout the history of the Music Snobs. But I'm going to take School Days from 1988 and leave the film.
Damn.
Jesus.
You know, I found that... you know, over the years, I periodically reach for the soundtrack, play it either in full or nearly in full, but I have not had the desire to see the movie, and I can't even remember the last time that I saw this movie, how long it's been.
Well, hang on, I just want to clarify, are you saying, when you say leave the movie, are you saying you saw it once, you got everything you needed from it. It was perfect. You don't ever need to see it again. It's not the kind of movie that you need to experience repeat viewings of.
That is exactly what I'm saying. And I think that this is why I say I was doing some soul searching, because I think that because I lived through that period in real time and had similar experiences that are outlined in the movie, it doesn't speak to me anymore.
Can I just say that knowing you as I know you, knowing where you went to university and your political outlook, I could picture you in that movie. And you know, I mean all this as a compliment, you know.
I'm taking it as such.
But, just knowing you as I know you, I would say like the experiences depicted in that movie, some of those are part of the fabric of your life.
And so, but let me just talk about the premise of the film, just very, very, very briefly. It deals with Half Pint. It's played by Spike Lee. And the whole film takes place in Atlanta on a historically, an HBCU, an historically black college university. It was filmed on Morehouse College's campus, which is Spike's undergrad alma mater. And Spike plays a pledge. He's pledging the most popular fraternity on campus, Gamma Phi Gamma. The dean of pledges is played by Giancarlo Esposito, Big Brother Almighty. And Half Pint is the cousin of Dap, who's played by Lawrence Fishburne. And Dap is leading student protests against the university administration for either for their stance on divesting in South Africa. So we're dealing with late 80s apartheid, was still a system in South Africa.
Was this before or after Do the Right Thing?
This is the film before Do the Right Thing.
Right before.
This film leading up to
after
that.
After She's Got to Have It, after before Do the Right Thing.
After She's Got to Have It. It deals with color clashes, light skin versus dark skin, lighter skin blacks, black females in particular, wearing contacts, colored contacts, which was something that I had experienced with girls that I knew in high school and also in college. Dealt with hair politics, good hair, bad hair, good hair being straight. And you know, he was trying to cram a lot in the film. It's an important film to watch, and I'm going to do something that's a clear contradiction, but you'll see why once I'm finished. He's telling too much story, so at parts it's difficult to follow. Things are left underdeveloped. But this was a time where, and it which still exists, but this was a time in the early renaissance of late 80s, 90s black cinema where Spike wasn't guaranteed to get another shot at making a movie.
So he's leaving it all out in the field.
He's leaving it all out. And, you know, and I can't knock that. But again, it doesn't hold up over time. And in the previous episode of Snobs on Film, you know, I really waxed poetic over how Do the Right Thing captured that time. It was a movie that was made and released at the right time, even though he was telling a lot of story in that too, right?
But timeless.
You're right. It's timeless. And you know, in school days, it just doesn't have that sense of timelessness for me. But the soundtrack is gorgeous. I mean, it's just gorgeous. I think it's his best soundtrack to any of his movies that he's done. Side note, She's Gotta Have It, it's more of a score. And that's beautiful also. But, you know, on this, there's The Butt by EU, go-go music, not known too much outside of Metro DC area. Went number one at the time. Beautiful song by Phyllis Hyman called B1, a sleeper song for her. Two beautiful arrangements of a song called One Little Acorn, the first being played by Terrence Blanchard on trumpet, accompanied by Kenny Barron, the master of piano, and also a solo version of One Little Acorn, piano by Kenny Barron. There's a Negro spiritual that opens the film called I'm Building Me a Home. I believe that's the Morehouse Choir that sings that. Tisha Campbell, Jasmine Guy, and I forget the third actress do a song called I Don't Want to Be Alone Tonight. Good and Bad Hair. Good and Bad Hair. This is another thing where Spike, knowing that he was selling so much Tory, tried to abstract it, conflate it even, in a musical number in maybe the first third of the film between the light-skinned females and the dark-skinned females. And it's a song called Good and Bad Hair. And it's done in a, you know, in like a beauty shop setting in the film. I literally listened to this album several times, you know, during any given year. And I've done this for the last 31 years. But the film, the last time that I saw it, I think I've only seen it twice.
Interesting. It's interesting how a movie can, on one hand, a film can capture something that you can digest and then not need to revisit. Then on the other hand, a film can capture something that you feel like you need to revisit every once in a while. That's interesting how, if you look at that, you know, School Days versus Do the Right Thing, somebody could probably do a dissertation on that.
But you all had a significant reaction when I said it.
Yeah, because I haven't watched School Days in forever. And to be fair, School Days isn't as readily available, as far as, you know, it's not something that pops up on television. I think, you know, Do the Right Thing or Malcolm X or some of his other films pop up more on television than Do the Right.
And you may not rate it in your top three movies of Spike Lee.
No. I mean, I'm like Arthur. It came out in what, 87?
It was released.
So that preceded my college years. I wasn't in college then. So for me, I don't have the nostalgia as far as like when I first saw it, I didn't connect to it in the way that maybe Arthur did, because he was a couple years older than me. But looking back now, you know, when I did eventually see it, because I don't think I saw it in the theaters. I was too young. It was rated R.
Yeah, it was rated R.
Yes. It was rated R. So when I was, I don't think I saw it until I was in college. And then, of course, I could relate to it a little bit better.
For me,
it's still, I agree with your, you know, breakdown of it, in the sense that, yeah, I saw it, but I don't feel the need to re-see it or see it again. Does School Days, you think, work better as a series of vignettes? As vignettes about college life?
You mean like as opposed to something like Grownish or something like that?
Well, as opposed to Clockers, which to me works better as a full, compelling narrative, you know, from start to finish.
You know, I think so. That's a good point. It would be interesting if School Days was the Netflix show as opposed to She's Gotta Have It. I mean, there's a lot of information to mine
in the storylines. You didn't have a different world. I think A Different World became that in some aspects. It became the rated PG version, the PG culturally diverse version of School Days, the very PG version, the Cosby version. You can't say Cosby and PG anymore. So you know what I'm saying, though. That analogy is not the same anymore. But, you know, go back like 10 years ago. If I would have said the Cosby version or something, you would have said rated G or PG at the most. Version. So yeah, it was like that version of School Days. But if it weren't for that, yeah, I think that would make a much better or more compelling TV show. Because those, when you take a bunch of ideas, like you said, Spike had a lot he wanted to say at that time and cram it in that movie. I think it got distilled into vignettes, you know, and he came up with all these different vignettes and kind of combined them with a narrative. And maybe that narrative wasn't as compelling as something like Clockers or Malcolm X or Mo Better.
Bring us home, man.
So for my, I actually have two picks, and I have one. The first one is a song that I love, and the movie that I not only can leave behind, I've never even seen it and have no desire to see it. And that is, the song is Lose Yourself. Eminem's Lose Yourself, and the movie is 8 Mile. The song "Lose Yourself," I think, is, I mean, it's an anthem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's to me, it's on the same level of Eye of the Tiger and some of those. You know, you put it on in the gym and you get hyped. Mm-hmm. It's just you know, has some of his best lines, and I think that he spit in there. You know, success is my only motherfucking option. Failure is not. You know, it just, to me, it's almost as if I didn't need to see the movie. I really didn't have an urge to see this film, and I remember when it dropped, I didn't get a lot of, you know, people coming up like, oh man, the movie was great, you got to see it. And this was at the height of his fame, I think, mm-hmm. when that movie came out. But it didn't like, you know, rock the summer, though. I think it came out in the summer, but it wasn't like that, you know, that one film that you had to see. Mm-hmm. So I never felt the urge to see it. And this song, though, was just so powerful to me at the time. And if I felt like, man, I got so much out of that song, I was good. I didn't really need anything else. And I still listen to that song to this day. You know, I listen to it sometimes at the gym or whenever I hear it on XM, you know, I turn it up. I think it's a great movie song, but for some reason it never compelled me to go watch this film. So I don't know if you guys have seen 8 Mile, but I've never seen it to this day.
I saw that in the cinema.
What did you think? I imagine this song was at the climactic moment of the movie, right?
No idea. I can't remember.
Damn.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's important. It taught a lot of people about cypher culture and freestyles and hip-hop. I think it was a lot of people's first introduction to that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a coming-of-age story that's replicated in many other films before that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was at the height of that. He was at his peak at that moment. And I think it's funny, man, because I've never seen the film, but one of my favorite parts about the movie is it was referenced in another film, and I can't remember it to save my life right now. But two of the characters were arguing over the Mekhi Phifer reference in that song in "Lose Yourself," and how it really doesn't make sense in the sense that he's referring to Mekhi Phifer as if Mekhi Phifer wasn't the actor in the movie. Mm-hmm. But and they're arguing back and forth, and I can't remember what comedy that was in, but that almost made me want to watch the film more so than Lose Yourself, but not enough. Okay, so that was my first pick. So the second pick is actually a full soundtrack. It's Parade and Under the Cherry Moon. I didn't hate Under the Cherry Moon as much as most people did at that time. Like, you know, obviously it got panned by the critics, deservedly so, in my opinion. But I found some good things about that movie. I remember I went to see it in the theater. There was a lot of hype around that film because it was the movie, you know, the first movie he did after Purple Rain, because it preceded, I think the next year he did the Sign of the Times film, almost to like cleanse the palate of everyone who has seen Under the Cherry Moon. But I didn't hate it as much as everybody else did. But similar to Arthur's experience with School Days, it's not as if I was living on the French Riviera at that point in time in my life, and playing piano in a restaurant or whatever like Prince was doing, and being a gigolo on the side. None of that happened to me. But I do, that movie, I saw it, and it was, you know, at that moment in time, this was 86, I think. Prince was, you know, one of the, if not the biggest pop star on the planet. So I saw the film, you know, whatever, and I've seen it once or twice since then, but I've never felt the need to revisit that movie. The soundtrack, on the other hand, this album, when I remember this was the first album I bought with my own money, the first Prince album I bought with my own money, and went into the store and actually bought it. And I remember I was thrown off at first because I knew it had something to do with the film, but Parade was on the, it said Parade instead of Under the Cherry Moon. Mm-hmm. I think it was on the side, written on the side. And then I think underneath it had smaller print, you know, it's, you know, it connected itself to the film. But this is a perfect album, you know, start to finish. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this album. It's even for Prince, it was a bold album at the time. And it's got, you know, probably the most radio friendly song he's ever done in his career is on here, which is Kiss, and then coupled with songs like I Wonder You, which is one of my favorite Prince songs ever, New Position, songs that, you know, if you're not a Prince head, you probably have no idea, you probably never even heard of these tracks. But this, you know, this soundtrack to this film, which I can't, you know, having only seen the movie a few times, I can't really remember how well the soundtrack was placed in the film. But I do think that if I had to make a choice, I would absolutely, without question, choose to take this soundtrack and leave the film behind.
Well, you're not going to get much argument from me. You know, I'm more inclined to go see that. Whereas Graffiti Bridge, for example, I'm still trying to not, I'm still trying to unsee that movie.
Can't wait to season two.
And this is a full lid on season one of The Music Snobs and Snobs on Film. Thank you for supporting us. Again, we will return early 2020, and maybe have a few gems dropped along the way. Take care, everybody.
I feel the same way about Ray Parker Jr. Ghostbusters. Listen, when that song, Snobs or whatever, let's be real, that song is a prime example of a song and the movie being a perfect match for each other.
Oh, hell yeah.
So yeah, I didn't rock that back in the day on its own, but whenever it came on in the film in the beginning of that movie, it was like, yeah, Ghostbusters, you know.
So neither of you are going to cut for Ghostbusters 2, Bobby Brown's On Our Own.
Hey, Bobby Brown's On Our Own, great track to a movie that didn't live up to that song.
Yeah. Never saw it.
Oh, God.